session number 23821, Reel 6. Mr. Halliday, Reel 6. We're talking about your time with the Bullens still in 19th Escort Group, based at Liverpool. Now, mainly, the whole period really, but mainly between December and May. What about the long leaves you mentioned? You'd presumably go back to London.
Yeah, we would. We would get 6-7 days leave about every 6 months. Of course, for me, that meant a trip to back home to London. And I can well remember Crewe Station. All trains seemed to stop at Crewe. And we used to stop at change at Crewe, and it was always in the early hours of the morning, waiting for the connection. One of the lesser happy memories of my time in the service, when you get back home, well, it was a case of...
You were still living in Lambeth, were you?
Yeah. Back home, it was a case of, well, the family were obviously keen to see you, and quite honestly, it was... The six or seven days, particularly evenings, were usually spent in the pub, drinking and playing darts.
You mentioned dance halls, though. Why dance halls in London, but not in Liverpool? What was the?
Well, where we lived, in actual fact, up at Stockwell, there was a dance hall, and it used to have a seven-piece band that used to play there. And that was quite nice. Sometimes it caused, there was a little bit of problem because quite a number of the people in attendance were American servicemen. And it was generally felt that they were commandeering our women folk. But...
Did that lead to fights, or was it sort of just a resentment?
I didn't see any fights, but there was certainly resentment on it, over it. That was really what Lee was made up of. But there wasn't a hell of a lot more that you could do, to be quite frank. The important point of it was to get away. For these 5 or 6 days, to get away from the routine of the patrols and that. So it was a case of a change was as good as a rest. Then, as I said, we went back to the sweeps. But then, in 1945, April, we...
So now, anything happened in between, or was it just routine sweeps?
Just routine sweeps.
Now, it's my impression so far that you've not actually opened fire in anger with the Anakin.
No.
Now, would that be correct? Or
no, yes, that's correct at this stage. No, I hadn't opened fire in anger at that stage, up to that stage. In April, we... were ordered to join the convoy. What was the number of it?
Was it JW66?
JW66. And that was to Murmansk. On the way up,
Was it to Murmansk or Pollyanna, or are they the same
place?
Well,
Pollyanna,
is it the same place? I'm not
well, it's the base, really. Pollyanna was the base there, yeah. At Murmansk, yeah. Yeah. On the way up, we it was a quiet trip.
This was your first time
on the Russian run.
What were the conditions like? I mean, it was April, but...
Actually, it was quite pleasant. The weather was pretty calm going up. And at that time of the year, of course, there's a hell of a lot of daylight. It was quite a good trip up. There were a few skirmishes with contacts, but we apparently were succeeding in keeping the U-boats running very, very deep. But there was no losses on either side.
Any sign of aircraft? They were your business, but any sign of them?
No, we had no. Of course, we had aircraft carriers with us. Well, we certainly had the Vindex, and we had got to the stage, I think, with the convoys that the German aeroplanes that used to tow the convoys ceased to exist because we had fighter planes on aircraft carriers, which would obviously see them off.
So you had one of those little aircraft, was it the Vindex, or do you know which one was with you?
We had the Vindex, Vindex was a fleet carrier.
And that was with you?
Yeah, yeah.
So anything happened on the way out that you remember? Or?
Well, there was one incident there, and that was on the question of mines. We had... At the same time as we went up, we were joined for part of the way with a mine laying expedition, which apparently the Russians were not too keen on. But we had to prove to them that we were laying the mines deep enough so that the surface craft would be okay, but... the mines were really laid to catch U-boats. So if you laid them, shall we say, 25 feet below the water, then most surface craft were quite safe to go over the top. But how effective these mines were against U-boats, I don't know. But nevertheless... But it did cause some concern, apparently, from the Russians that we were laying mines in their home waters. But we did have some of the mines break away, whether they were the ones that we had laid or some that had been laid earlier. And I can remember that we had a bit of target practice shooting at the mines.
What with video looking or with rifles?
First of all, the officers on the bridge decided that they would have a go with rifles, and they weren't very successful. And then, in actual fact, I was invited with other gunners to have a go, and we were just as successful.
You have to actually hit the... Is it the horns? Or
well, that's the point, really, that you're supposed to hit the horns. Because...
Which is a small target.
Yeah. I mean, you could be lucky, in actual fact. As I said earlier, that... with the Oerlikons, that you had three types of ammunition. You had the tracer, the armoured piercing, and the ATI explosive.
Now, were these different rounds loaded in the drum?
No, they were.
Or would a drum be?
These would be set in the drum like that. It was very, very careful with regards to loading, because part of the function of me as the gun layer, as the gunner, together with my number two, would be in actual fact to load, and we would.
What order would you put them in, and why?
Well, we would usually told by the gunner, by the petty officer, what
was required. And I seem to think that it would be somewhere about 3 armoured piercing, 3 80s and 2 tracers, and then you'd repeat that throughout the drum, loading it. And obviously the tracers was merely to help you with regards to sighting the target. The armoured piercing and the 80s were the ones that were supposed to do the damage, but the tracers were to show you the way, more or less.
Did the tracers, I mean, some problems with early tracers was that they didn't actually go the way the bullets were going. Do you know what I mean? Because they were a different weight. Well, by this time, would the tracers accurately show where the bullets were going? The, you know, the HE and the...
I think so. I think we'd got over the earlier difficulties by that time. I mean, you've got to remember that I'm talking about, and we'll be talking about, the fire and anger in 1945, towards the end of the war. Well, they may have had these problems earlier in the war, but...
So where the tracers went was where your bullets were going. You were confident of that?
Yeah, because I can remember target... And we from time to time, of course, we would have to do some target shooting. It was usually with a aeroplane pulling a drone, do they call them?
Drone, I think. But.
Yeah. And so you could see, actually, the tracers functioning. And they appeared to be pretty accurate. If they weren't, it wasn't a cause, I don't think, of the ammunition. It was probably a cause of the gunner.
Were they an accurate gun? Was it accurate?
It was a very accurate.
Not when you're trying to hit a bit of a horn on a mine, but for a bit, was it, you know, could you normally hit what you're aiming at?
Yeah, but you've got to remember that when you're talking about a mine that's floating in the water, that isn't a stable target. The point is, though, that it's going up and down with the waves and that, so... with the best will in the world, even a sharpshooter with a rifle would have great difficulty. It'd be more luck than judgment if, in actual fact, he hit one of the horns. But the point is, of course, that a normal rifle bullet would not penetrate the shell of the mine itself.
It was a pretty accurate. Why do you mean? I forgot to ask earlier. Were you taught about deflection shooting? In other words, you didn't aim at the target; you aimed well in front of it.
That was all part of your training, in actual fact. But as I say, then subsequently, you, with the practice with the aircraft and drones pulled by drones, obviously you put that into practice. I mean, because the aircraft was a moving target, and so was the drone. So you had to offshoot. But I think it's true to say that the tracer was of great assistance. It really put you onto the target.
The other thing is, there's a couple of a story about that you told me off tape about an Oerlikon barrel that went over.
We're
not going to get much of a chance. I don't think this happened then, but it happened somewhere. Can you just tell that story?
Yeah.
Because it was.
Yeah, we were in Liverpool at the time, and I'd stripped my gun down, and a chap on the Oerlikon next to me, that was more towards the stern, he had also stripped his gun down and reassembled it, but unfortunately he appeared to have forgot to lock the barrel, and...
When he put it back together?
When he reassembled it. The last thing to do was to make sure you lock the barrel on. And, of course, it was a question of just testing it. Of course, you can test it without ammunition in. What happened was that the barrel shot away and went over the side and was lost somewhere down in the bottom of Gladstone Dock. The laddie responsible was subsequently called before the first lieutenant defaulted. And my understanding of that was that Jimmy decided, or the first lieutenant decided,
this
that Delaware, that the best discipline that could have been applied was that the rating was told that he would have to pay for the barrel, and this would be stopped from his pay. I don't know how far this went, but that was, we understand the outcome of it. But of course, it caused a laugh in the ship, and the poor chap himself.
Do you remember his name?
No, I can't remember his name, but he did have his leg pulled.
Now, we're on this, you're telling me about the mines, floating mines. What happened next? Before, you know, this is on the way to Pollyanna, to Murmansk.
Well, the point is, as I say, I did not see any success with regards to our attempts to sink them, so it was just a question of, okay, we had other things on our mind. I mean, we was in, after all, we were taking a convoy up, and we weren't there, just on a sort of mine chute. And whether somebody, another ship following up, took care of them or not, I don't know. The important point was, of course, at least the lookouts had spotted the mines. Well, we got to we got there eventually, and we anchored in Kola Bay.
Did you go ashore at Pollyanna?
We didn't go up to Pollyanna, which Pollyanna, Murmansk, that is. We stopped at Kola Bay. Yes. I did go ashore twice. Wasn't very, very encouraged by what I saw.
In what way?
When we obviously was at anchor, so we went over with a boat and landed there, and it was pretty barren sort of country. And there was a track, and I can't really call it anything other than a track, which you could walk along. And about every 50 yards, there was an armed Russian soldier. And we were told that we had to stay on the track, and that to move off, we were in danger, in actual fact, of these sentries, or if you want to call it that, responding. So, of course, we did stick to these tracks. There was... we then came to an area where there was some buildings, and they were flogging some bits and pieces, souvenirs, and I can recall that I myself purchased a couple of knives. Mine, the blades were aluminium. They were daggers, but blades were a very thin aluminium. There were nothing lethal about them. And the handles were sort of different coloured glass. Unfortunately, what happened later on, of course, I lost them. They went down with the ship. But it wasn't a very pleasant trip, and ashore, there was no place to go and have a drink or no entertainment whatsoever. It was just the fact that, okay, you've been there, and okay, I've been ashore in Russia. I've actually landed there. But... not something that you would want to, you would look forward to. In actual fact, if one had any sort of leanings of sympathy towards Russia, this didn't help. Bearing in mind that there were, this indicated what we were hearing from those that were based actually in Pollyanna, that the Russians were very, very suspicious of us.
And bearing in mind, of course, that we had, under convoys, particularly the earlier convoys, where there had been a terrible loss with regards to ships and men, they didn't seem to be appreciative of the assistance that they were being given. And that was a little bit annoying, to be quite frank, because, after all, the Royal Navy and the Merchant Navy had, if you like, left themselves open to all sorts of dangers in getting the materials to assist the Russians in their fight. But anyhow, after we was there, I think it was somewhere in the region of 4 days or so. And on the 29th, we sailed, and that was to accommodate RW66, the convoy back to the UK.
Was it RW or RA?
RW. Sure it was RW.
Definitely RW. So, you were escorting...
Sorry, RJ. RJ coming back.
RJ, yeah. Not RA.
No, it was RA. That's right, it was JW66 and RJ66 coming back.
And you were escorted through Kola Inlet, I believe.
Yeah,
well, you've taken all the way back, but...
Yeah,
well, the Kola Bay, of course, is obviously an enclosed area. And outside is, of course, the Kola Inlet. And we sailed on the 29th, but the captain did speak to us on the tannoy and said that there was a large number of U-boats waiting outside. These had been sighted by aircraft. But nevertheless, we would still be going out. And we went out, and I think there was something like 4 escort groups, 17, 18 ships, corvettes and frigates, yes, and a couple of, and some destroyers, and
so there's a lot of destroyers about to escort this, frigates and destroyers.
Well, as I say, there was 17, 18 of us in number when we went out, representing 4 different escort groups. Once we got outside, we fanned out and started the normal routine of comprehensive sweeps, and it wasn't very long before there was a sound of explosions. They were from depth charges, obviously, and then suddenly a U-boat broke the surface about half a mile off us. And she had been forced to the surface by a squid that had been dropped by the Lock Inch. We were ordered to open fire with small arms, which I joined in with my Oerlikon, and this was my initial sort of baptism of firing at the enemy with anger. Whether I did any damage or not, I do not know.
But you hit her.
Pardon?
You hit the submarine.
Yeah, you could see your traces going there, but of course there was others. There was other guns that was firing as well. But there was one incident there which I think's worth mentioning, and that is that this U-boat had been forced to the surface by, as I say, a squib. And what was actually amazing was that they actually came out and manned their gun and actually got a round off before they were eventually sunk with shells from the Lock Inch. You had to admire them, really. You would call it heroism, patriotism, or any otherism you want to, but it was quite remarkable that I would have thought that popping up like that
and looking around and seeing nothing else but surface ships, was the time to throw in a towel. But that was not so. But there were 13 survivors from that destroyer, from that U-boat.
Was this the U-307?
Yeah. That was the 307.
Did you actually see her go down?
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, you could see her. She was hit by shells from, that was from the Lockheed. Because the point is, though, that this was a strange thing. I mentioned earlier that we had, our main armament was a 3-inch gun, or three 3-inch guns. But they were known to us as elephant guns, because that was about the largest thing that it would bring down. There were many instances, and indeed it happened with the Goodall, where in actual fact the shells failed to penetrate inch thick holes. They were known to bounce off of the outer casing of U-boats, and in the case of the Goodall, when we was asked to sink a merchant ship that had been gutted, and we didn't leave these wrecks floating about. If they were, there was nobody on them and they were beyond repair, the point was that you sunk them yourself because they could be a hazard. Even though we scored many hits, or a number of hits, there was no penetration with the 3-inch.
You saw this when it happened.
But the I'm not sure. I think the lock inch, because they weren't captain class, but I think they had 3.6, and that made all the difference. But anyhow, the 307 disappeared. There was other explosions going on around and about. You could hear them. Then we got a contact, and we're just moving into attack when there was a almighty explosion. And what had happened was that we had been hit by a torpedo on the port side. The fact that it was on the port side was immaterial, to be quite frank, because it ignited the 3-inch magazine, and the force of that explosion disintegrated the forepart of the ship. The bridge and the mast were thrown back towards the stern. My action station was on the Ehrlichan, just above the bridge. The force of the explosion had buckled the super deck. That's, you know, you've got your main deck and then you've got the deck above it is a super deck. And this caused my gun mounting to collapse. I can never understand that, because it was made of heavy cast iron, but I suppose it was where the deck had buckled. It also, I found that my right leg, or more towards the ankle, was trapped, and the barrel, which was still hot, was also laying across my leg.